We're holding on page 206 in Rav Basra, Ois Kufchav Beis. A couple of Mishnayos towards the end of the parak talk about various cases where two people have died, and we don't know which one died first, and there are details of what happens as far as the Yerusha. For example, imagine you have the cases the Mishnah brings, there's a house collapse on both of them, but of course it's going to be the same with any other kind of disaster, and you don't know which one died first. So say, for example, you have a father and his son died in such a thing. So now the question is, did the father die first, then the son yaushened him, and now in turn, if the son owes people money, then they can collect from that, or not, did the son die first, and then the father, and then other children of the father, or other relatives of the father, as the case may be, are going to yarshin him and not the son. So you have Machlokas v'Shana v'Hillel about it, and you have a couple of other such cases in Mishnayos. Then you have a case where it was a man and his mother, who both died in this house collapse, or whatever. There you have the Mishnah says both v'Shana and v'Hillel finally agree that about the disposition of the Nechassim. Along comes Rabbi Akiva and says that actually, no, in this case also there's still an argument. So Ben Azai says to Rabbi Akiva, it's not bad enough that we have all those cases that Beis Shama and Beis Hillel arguing, and now you have to give us another one when we other Chachamim hold that they finally agree on something. So the expression he says in the Mishnah is, Ala Chalukim Anu Mitzarin, we're concerned about the ones where they have the Machlokas. You have to realize that in that time, Machlokas was still a relatively new thing. Shammai and Hillel themselves had only a couple of machlokas, and Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel had a couple of hundred, but still, this is only a generation or two before Ben Azai and Rabbi Akiva, so it was still a relatively new thing that we should have an ongoing machlokas like this. So Ben Azai tells him it's bad enough, but he says, but now we have finally have a case where they agree, and you're coming to tell us that they argue. So the Gemara says, Amr Rav Simloi, Hada Amra, this tells us, Ben Azai Talmud Chover de Rabbi Akiva Hava. Now Ben Azai was a Talmud Chover of Rabbi Akiva, meaning that he started out as a Chover of his. So Rashbam explains, they started out both learning by Rabbi Eliezer, but Ben Azai was younger, so he wasn't able to understand the Svaris of Rabbi Eliezer as thoroughly as Rabbi Akiva. So he ended up learning by somebody else. So he ended up learning just the Gemara over there, just the facts rather than the Svara. Later on, he came to Rabbi Akiva, then became a Talmud of his to learn Svara. So therefore, he's called a Talmud Chover because he started out as a Chover and then became a Talmud. A parenthetical note in Rashi over here that says the other, that actually brings from Rabbeinu Gershom, that we see from that, that when a person is younger, better he should focus exactly that, on Gemara, on learning as much material as possible, and then when he's older, then he can work on Svara, on learning the Svaras of him. Anyway, we see that Ben Azai was Talmud Chover, Rabbi Akiva, Dekarmelai Shabasa, because he speaks to him in second person directly and says to him that you have come. Had Rabbi Akiva been Ben Azai's Rebbe, he would have used a more respectful expression. He would have said Shabbat Rabbeinu or something like that. Shabbosa is the kind of thing you speak directly, so that's the way a Talmud speaks. That's the way a Chover speaks. So since we know that Ben Azai at one point was a Talmud of Rabbi Akiva, then that means he has to have been a Talmud Chover. Get Poshet Perek Asiri. Most of this Perek talks about various dinim of shtaris. So one thing, a shtar has to have a date. So and the Gemara deals with certain details of how the dates are written. Now, of course, in those times, it was very common that you would write the date based on the name of the ruler. The Gemara tells us in Gittin, the Mishnah tells us in Gittin, for example, that they were supposed to do that. Mishum Shloim Malchus, in particular, in a get, you should write according to the reigning power, and that shows them honor in that way, like the Goyish rulers appreciate that we show them such importance, we show them such covered, that in our important legal documents, we date things according to them. Later on, in later times, the Goyim don't care about it as much, which is why nowadays we just date things the B'riyas Ha'olam and have done with it. Anyway, so the Gemara tells, there was a shtar where the date was given as in the year of Pliny the Orchon. So what does that mean? It doesn't say what year. Rashbam learns that Orchon is a name for a king, as the Gemara is going to go on to say. In the first year that he ascends the throne, he's called Orchon. Rashbam learns that comes from the word in Aramaic, arich, which means proper. So like he's properly seated and properly seated on his throne, and he's a new ruler. There's different other possibilities what the title Orchon can mean. Habona at the bottom of the page over here brings another point as well. It's meant as a compliment to him. Yarich Yomim Amamlachta. Ari Orchon Meloshen Orech and Meloshen that he should have a long and prosperous reign. Well, that's the question. So that's the question, but it doesn't mean his first year, doesn't mean his second year, etc. So Rav Chanina says, we have to check what actual year was it when this fellow became Orchon. They had, by the way, in the ancient Greek city-states, they had, in a number of them, they had their rulers bore this title of Orchon. It also comes from a Greek word that means ruler. In English, you have words like monarch that come from it, and arch-enemy, and different things like that, with A-R-C-H, which means the ruling or the leading, the ruler or the leader or whatever. Anyway, so Rav Chanina says, find out when this guy became Orchon, when he became the ruler, because we call him Orchon only in the first year of his reign. So therefore, if they wrote Pliny Orchon, then it means it was in his first year. Tosfos, by the way, says, even though Rashbam is saying over here that we're talking about a king, not necessarily does Tosfos say we're talking about a king, because the Gemara is going to talk about, because the Gemara goes on to say, it's not here in Ein Yaakov, what happens if he's deposed and then reappointed. Now, that doesn't happen very often with kings, that the Gemara should even bother asking the question. So rather, Tosfos says this is a kind of official that they would generally appoint for a one-year term, you know, similar to nowadays. Presidents have four-year terms, governors also have two or four-year terms, or whatever. So in those times, they had a position called Orchon, which was often, generally speaking, a person would be elected or appointed or whatever to it for 1 year. Back in Roman history, La Marshall, they had for hundreds of years, they named their years that way. Every year would be named for the two consuls who were in charge that year. So I say here would be a similar kind of thing. Okay, so they want to ask the German to Arich Malchusei. Fine, but how do we know? The word Orchon means Zavka in his first year. Maybe Orchon is Meloshen Orich, Meloshen long, like he's ruled a long time. And then we don't know what year of his the Shtar was written in. Rabbi Oshi explains, no. Kachmin Hogashal Umazu, this is the way this nation does things, the Greeks or the Romans or whatever. Shana Rishon, a Kurdan, the Greeks, the Pashas. Shana Rishon, a Kurdan like Orchon, Shnia Kurdan like Gigun. If he serves a second year, they don't call him the title Orchon anymore, they call him Digun, which the Gemara goes on to say. Digun literally means two-cornered, but sometimes they used it to mean twice. So in other words, he's now in his second term, he's now in the second year of his term in this position. So therefore, if it says Orchon, then you can be sure it's his first year. Now, the Gemara goes on to tell, Now, at the beginning of the Perek, the Gemara spends a while talking about two different types of shtaris that they had in those days. You have get poshut, which get doesn't just mean a get, it means any kind of shtar. So a poshut one, like the one we're familiar with, they write the sofer writes a line, another line, until you get to the bottom of it, the Edom sign at the bottom of it, and that's that. They're the familiar ksubas that we all see, gittin that we see once in a while, etc., all written that way. They also had a format called get mekusher, which was made in a much more complicated way. The Gemara explains the reason for it is, the reason why that format was made in the first place was because if a Kohen wants to divorce his wife, now a Kohen, if he divorces his wife, he can never remarry her, and Kohenim are stereotypically very hot-tempered. So no offense to the Kohenim who are here, but in any case, so there's a concern. If a Kohen decides to divorce his wife and they write out a get poshut, which doesn't take very long, by the time he rethinks it, she's gotten the get and it's too late. He can never remarry her. Therefore, they came up with a format called get mekusher, which is a lot more complicated to prepare. That'll give the guy time to calm down. How is a get mekusher prepared? Rashi, in other places in Shas, and Rashbam over here, explains that basically they would write one line of it, then they would fold it over to make a pleat, and they would sew it over the blank space that was there, then they would write the next one, and fold it over and sew it, so it came out looking kind of like an accordion, like a fan or an accordion or something, with each pleat stitched to the next one. Different other Rishonim mentioned different other possibilities. The problem is, in the times of the Rishonim, nobody was using a get mekusher anymore, so they had to basically reconstruct what it's like based on the Gemara's descriptions. a number of Rishonim bring from the Raivan that it had, that they would write it in such a way it had straps made out of the parchment, that the parchment itself would be made in such a way where you have the ends of it would be cut to form ribbons, and like you'd write a line of the shtar and then fold over those sticking out ribbons over it and tie them and then write the next line and so forth, and it would come out like that. The Yad Ramah says similarly, except he has the ribbons sticking out from the top and the bottom. They found among the Dead Sea Scrolls ones that are somewhat like the Yad Ramah describes. They have strings attached to them where they would roll it up. Every so often they would roll it up and tie the strings and then write the next line, whatever. It's a much more complicated format. So the Gemara says, "Hahuma kusher da'asav kameh de Rebbe." One time they brought such a shtarma kusher to Rebbe. Now, even though originally they designed it to be used for gifting, in practice they would use it for other kinds of shtaris as well. But Omer Rebbe, Ein's man was there. And Rebbe says, wait a minute, there's no date on this shtar. Omer Rebbe Shimon Rebbe, said Rebbe Shimon, his son tells him, Rebbe, he says, Shema ben ksharav hum muvla. Maybe the date is embedded deeply within the ksharim. Whether you learn that those are pleats or ties or whatever it is exactly, maybe the date is hidden among those. Sure enough, Palye, he opened it up, he cut it open, v'chazi, and he saw the date. Now, Rebbe thought that Reb Shimon was the one who had written the shtar. So Rebbe looked with a very upset expression at his son Reb Shimon. He thought Reb Shimon himself had written it. Now Rashbam says two possibilities of what he objected. One is that Rebbe didn't like the idea of using a shtar makusher altogether. Even though the Chachamim of earlier generations had come up with that format, by Rebbe's times they weren't using it much anymore, and Rebbe didn't want people to be using it because it's very complicated to do, and it's very easy to get it wrong. The Gemara has very detailed rules of how it has to be written so that it's not puzzled, so it can't be forged or altered or whatever much more than a regular shtar, and therefore Sir Rebbe didn't like the idea of one being written altogether, and he thought Reb Shimon had written it. The other possibility, Rashbam says, is this particular one, because the date was so deeply buried inside it, so therefore at least whoever wrote it obviously didn't do a very good job, if even Rebbe himself almost missed that there was a date on it. The purpose of the ribbons or whatever it is exactly is basically, again, it's a more complicated format. So like we just said, this gives an Koyan who wants to divorce his wife time to rethink it. Yeah. Okay. Amalei, so Reb Shimon says, Lama Naksavte, I didn't write this shtar. El Yehuda Chaita Kasve. Yehuda, the tailor, wrote it.
That's in Tanya.
Yeah, Amalei, so Rebbe tells him, Kloch me Lashon Hara Kazeh, stay away from this kind of Lashon Hara. It's fine for you to defend yourself and say, I didn't write it, but there's no reason to be throwing Yehuda Chaita under the bus and say that he's the one who wrote it. Zimna Choda, now there was another time, Hava Yosef Reb Shimon Berebi, another time the same Reb Shimon Berebi was sitting, the Kaposik Sidra, the Sefer, or the Sefer Tilim Kamei Derebi. He was reading and he finished a section of Tilim, Rabbeinu Gershom says it means one of the five Sforim of Tilim, in front of Rebi. Reading from a handwritten scroll, as of course they had in those days, that's how everything was written. But Omer Rebbe, Kama Minyushu, Ksav Zeh, and Rebbe said, look how straight and neat this handwriting is. Omalei, and again, Reb Shimon tells him, Lava Na Ksavte, I didn't write this till of El Yehuda Chaita Kasve. Yehuda the tailor wrote it. Omalei, and again, Rebbe tells him, Kloch Maloshan Hara Kazeh, stay away from such Loshan Hara. Well, we have to ask, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with him saying that this tillim was written by Yehuda Chaita? In the case of the Shtarma Kosher, yeah, it's Lashon Hara, because Rebbe disapproves of such shtaris being written in the first place, or at least this particular one, because it was written with the date hidden away so much. So therefore, it's Lashon Hara to say that. Elahocha, my Lashon Hara Ikka. What Lashon Hara is there in saying that Yehuda Chaita wrote this very neat book of tillim? And the answer is Mishum de Reb Dimi, because the problem is about what Reb Dimi says. Detoni Reb Dimi Achur de Reb Safra La Olam Ayisapa Adam Tevase Shochaveiro. A person should never tell good things about somebody else. Shemitoch Tevase Boli de Roase. From saying good about him, it's going to come to bad. So Rashbam says that means when you speak a lot about him, you start speaking a lot of compliments about somebody. Sooner or later, somebody's going to mention, yeah, but there's also he does this. And therefore, that's going to lead to Lashon Hara. So that's Rashbam. Now, Marashah has a problem with that, though. That's true. You shouldn't say too much about the guy. But here, what's the too much? He's only saying that he wrote the Tillim. He's not giving him a lot of fulsome praise. So Marashah brings that rather what it is that it's more that you're doing it in public. To do it in public, it's more likely that one of the bystanders over there, one of the listeners, is going to say, yeah, but what about this that he did? So, as opposed to when you're doing it in private, adrabba, in fact, the Marsha brings from the Rambam's Pirush HaMishnayos and others that when we say kol amarid vorem mevi chet, and we say it at the end of the first perek, and then loy matzasi leguf tov mishsika, the Rambam gives a famous description over there that you have. You can break down the different kinds of speech into several categories: the ones that are outright osur, the ones that are optional, etc., etc. And among the ones that are good is to speak good things about tzaddikim and to speak good things about a fellow yid. So therefore, so Maharsha says the distinction would be whether it's in public or in private. Another point Maharsha says is, after all, how many people? I don't know. When you have to evaluate it, you have to see, are there likely to be people over there who are going to bring up something negative against him? I don't know. It's not necessarily a number of people. It's more you have to figure out what you have to know your audience.
Oh, right, so that's what knowledge. It's when you're talking to one person that you know he doesn't like this guy.
Well, there's that too, right?
The Chofetz Chaim writes it in Sefer, the one that the Red Rishab refused to sign on because of one thing.
Okay, so yes,
the one thing that they did not
so
have.
Maybe one person, yeah. If you know that he has it in for the guy, yeah, that's true. Marshall though points out another thing as well. After all, when we say if it's confirmed that Yehuda Chaita wrote this Sefer, then it means that whoever recognizes the handwriting of that is also going to recognize that it's the same handwriting on that Shtaima Kosher, which Rebbe had disapproved of. So therefore, it like helps uphold the previous thing that to speak negatively of him, that look, he didn't do a Shtaima Kosher properly. So therefore, in that particular case, then Rebbe is telling him, don't do that. Yeah, indeed, the Alter Rebbe brings that in Tanya as an example of that even you have a person doesn't even realize it's a minor aveda, as the Gemara is going to go on to say, many people throughout their lives are nichshol and such things, and you don't chapsich, yeah. Okay. So the Gemara continues, Amrav Amram Amrav, Sholosh Averis Einonim Nitzel Mehem B'chol Yom. There are three Averis that a person is not saved from them every day. In other words, almost inevitably a person is going to be over on these three things every day. Hirhu Avera, number one, thinking thoughts of Avera, in particular Znus, the Iyun Tefila. Now, what's Iyun Tefila? Rashbam says, Yesh Mefroshim, that after he davens, he thinks to himself, I daven with such kavana, surely Hashem is going to answer my tefillas.
The problem?
Well, that's a problem, yeah, because what do you mean? It's not like the Eidishta owes you one for having davened the kavana. However, Tosfos doesn't like that explanation, because are that many people really nichshol in that kind of thing? How many people seriously think like that I daven with such kavana, therefore for... No, Tosfos says, Iyun Tefila means poshut, that a person has a lack of kavana in davening. Which is a very common thing. Tosfos brings from a number of examples where even so iyun, in other words, that he fails to have iyun in tefillah. Iyun tefillah would mean that he fails to think in deeply into his davening. And in fact, the Tosfos brings from some Yerushalmis where a number of amiroim mention things along those lines where they were having trouble with kavana and davening as well. For example, there's the famous thing that Rabbi Yochanan says on himself, it's brought in many mamorim and sichas, that for example, he says, I'm glad that my head automatically, instinctively bows my moedim. So like, it's almost a muscle memory at that point, the fact that he bows my moedim because he wouldn't consciously think of it anymore. So that's Iyun Tefila. And the third thing, the Lashon Hara. And Lashon Hara. So you might ask Lashon Hara, Sakhar Daidach. You're telling me the average person is nichshol in Lashon Hara every day? Ela ema avak Lashon Hara. What it means is the dust of Lashon Hara, meaning something that's not full-fledged, outright Lashon Hara. But for example, Rashbam gives an example from a Gemara, there's a Gemara in Erchin that talks about, in some detail, about concepts involving Lashon Hara. And the Gemara mentions over there an example. Let's say, for example, you say, you'll always find a fire in Pliny's house. Now that can be a positive thing. That can be, for example, he's a big machnas orach. He always has things prepared for guests. Okay. But it can also mean a negative thing, depending on the tone of voice and whatever. It can also mean, look at this guy. He's a big spender. He's a glutton, and he's always got his barbecue running, and he's always, you know. So that kind of thing would be an example of avak lashon hara. Maharsha points out, the fact is, look, if we're saying that these are three things a person is nichshol in every day, how can you even call them averus? I mean, an avera, by definition, has to be something where a person has bechira chofshes not to do it. But if we're saying, einonim nitzel mehem b'chol yom, so Maharsha has an interesting explanation. We usually think of the word odam as the highest level of a person. You have in Hayomim, odam, ish, gever, and enosh. However, Maharsha learns over here, the fact is, the word Adam also means, after all, that a person is just a mortal, and you have in Sota a few days ago during one of the days of Chol HaMoed, one of the dafim in Sota that we learn now during Sfira, mentioned that the word Adam is short for Efer Dam Mora. A person is ashes, blood, and bile. That's a person's gashmiistic body is made out of those. So therefore, what we mean is if a person keeps himself on the level of Adam, then because he's made from Ofer ve'Efer, that means that he's not going to have proper kavana in davening. Because he has dam, which means he's hot-blooded and excitable, therefore that leads him to Avera, to Znus, or at least the thoughts of it. And because he has Mora, because he has bile, that makes him less well-disposed towards other people and brings him to Lashon Hara, or at least Avak Lashon Hara, and other Midas Rois. Now, if a person, on the other hand, transcends that and makes himself more than a Malach, then makes him more like a Malach, rather, then sure, he can overcome these things. So we don't mean it's inevitable he's going to do these things. As long as a person is an Adam nitzamahem b'cholim. But if he works to get himself higher than that, then taka he won't be nichshol in them.
Rabbi,
what
you doesn't
really
answer.
That's the answer.
Rabbi, it says that Rambam says in the Sifta Zayin that there's the three most terrible sins.
Yeah.
And
Lashon Hara is connected to Kolam. Yeah.
Why in your respect, maybe your opinion?
Why don't we talk about that later? Because I want to see if we can finish. Okay. I want to see if we can finish the Masechta today. Otherwise,
oh, good idea.
Otherwise tomorrow. Sorry about that, Rabbi. Otherwise tomorrow, what are we going to do? Half a shiur on it, and then have to start a new volume.
Right.
So the Gemara continues. Amar of Yehuda Amar Rav, Ruban Begezel. Most people are guilty of some degree of gezel. Because, people rationalize to themselves. And Ashram points out, they're doing a business deal, and they're going to keep something a little bit extra that they shouldn't. Umiutan Barayas, a minority of people are guilty of Arayas. Va'akol b'Lashon Hara, and everybody is guilty of Lashon Hara. So again, the Gemara says b'Lashon Hara, outright blatant Lashon Hara. No, avak Lashon Hara means avak Lashon Hara. Your average person is going to be guilty of such things. So Maharsha points out, by the way, the word avak Lashon Hara is also an interesting phrase. It means a person has a neshama, shenasat b'tahora hi. But he makes it dusty and dirty with Avak Lashon Hara. Therefore, we call it Avak in token of that. Primarily this is if a person doesn't learn the relevant halachas he has from Chavetz Chaim or from other relevant Sfarim. And again, like Maharsha says, if he doesn't work on himself to bring himself to a higher level is what we're talking about. There was an interesting vote from the Baal Shem Tov on it, by the way, that says that one more, what are we trying to be mekatrig on Jews and say that every day a person is over on these three Averas? He says, Faket, one meaning of it is we tell the Eveshter, the fact that nobody is nitzel from these things every day, bring Mashiach already so that we shouldn't have to, be nitzel from these things all the time. Okay. Further on, a couple of blocks later, the Gemara is dealing with the various miscellaneous dinim as far as checking over a shtar to make sure that it's valid and that nothing in it has been forged or altered or what have you and that the signatures are valid and so forth. So the Gemara says, Omar Abaye. If a person needs to show Basin a sample of his signature. So Nashbam explains, there's a case that the Gemara talks about in Ksubas, and also it's mentioned earlier in Or Masechta. You have a case like this. Imagine you have two Edim on a Shtar, Reuven and Shimon. Now, we need to do Kiyum, we need to validate that these are their genuine signatures. Normally, Reuven would come and testify that this is my signature, and Shimon would come and testify that this is mine, and that's that.
One passed away.
Yeah. Now, what happens? Yes, Shimon passed away. Now, let's say, for example, so normally you would say, fine, you get two other Edim, you get Levi and Yehuda, who recognize Shimon's handwriting, and they'll come to Beis Din and ask that.
That's okay.
The problem is, what happens if the only one who's available who recognizes Shimon's signature is Reuven? Now, the problem is, the Gemara explains,
three-fourths.
You can't have that three-fourths, in effect, three-fourths of the validity of the Shtar is going to depend on one aid, because Reuven is going to testify on his signature, or not even together with another aid. You're going to have Reuven himself is going to testify on his own signature, and he, together with Levi, are going to testify on Shimon's. That's no good. Instead, what the Gemara explains over there is Reuven should write his signature on a Shtar and deposit that in Beis Din. Now Baskin will find that, and then they can say, okay, so we don't need Reuven's testimony to validate his signature. Now they can compare the signature on the shtar that's being brought up for questioning in Baskin. They can compare it with the signature that now they have on file. And then, so now we're not depending on Reuven's signature, on Reuven's aiders for his own signature, and therefore now he, together with Levi, can testify on Shimon's signature, and we're good. So you have such a scenario, Rashbam explains, based on those Gemaras, where a person might have to sign his name on a blank piece of paper and deposit it in Beis Din. So Abai says, Hayman de boy le mechvik, simis yodi be beidina, if he has to show his signature in Beis Din, lo lachvi besoif megilta. He should not write it at the end of a piece of paper or parchment or whatever. Duma mashka, or further down, duma mashka chloacha, because somebody else might find that piece of paper with his signature on it, v'chosev, the masik beizuzi, and he's going to write above it a whole thing, I, the undersigned, owe Pliny X amount of money. What's man? And we learn in the mission. And we learn in the mission at the end of the last mission of the Masechta says, "Hoitziol of Tzav Yodesh Uchayev Loi." If for example, Shimon were to bring out a piece of paper that has Reuven's signature on it, and it says above it that Reuven, that I, the undersigned, owe Pliny X amount of money, even though there's no Edim on it, the halacha is Goyim and Nechosim Bnei Chorin. He will be entitled to collect from Reuven from Nechosim Bnei Chorin. So he won't be able to collect from Nechosim Mishrabodim, from property that Reuven had sold to other people, but he will be able to collect from Reuven's own property on the strength of this document. So you want to avoid that kind of thing. So therefore, Reuven should. So if he writes his signature at the top of a piece of paper, no problem, because there's no room above it to write any such thing. It wouldn't matter. No, wouldn't matter. That wouldn't matter. The signature on a shtar only works if it's at the bottom of a shtar, not if it's at the top.
Bottom means the last line.
The last line. Yeah. Yeah. There is a din. So there is a din, it mentions in this perek that, for example, if you have a shtar written all on one line together with the signatures, it's also valid. So fine, it would mean also you have to write it closer to the margin also, so there's no room to write something before it as well. So the Gemara tells, Ha'hub Bazvina, there was a toll collector, or a tax collector, whatever, a yid, the Osel Kameh D'Abaya. This guy came to Abaya, Omalei, and he says to him, Nachzi limar chasimis yode. Rebbe, Abaya, please show me, please give me a sample of your signature. Dechi osu rabbonon, because when other Talmid Chachamim come, and they're going to be bearing a document that says that you certified that they're a Talmid Chacham who is exempt from tolls or taxes, so I need to know whether it's genuine or not. Machvuli, they're going to show me their document, and I can compare it to your signature that now I have on file. And I'll allow them to cross the bridge or the ferry or whatever it is without paying the toll. So Abaya started, he was going to write for him his signature on the top of a piece of paper. This guy was a trickster. He tried without his, hoping that Abaya wouldn't notice, to like pull the Megillah further in his direction so that Abaya would sign further down on the page. Abaya tells him that Abaya are one step ahead of you. They already know this kind of thing that you could try, that kind of shtick. And therefore they warned, and they, as Abaya himself had said, to only sign at the top, so don't think you're going to get me to sign in the middle of the paper. In other words, in short, Abaya says, you learn from this. In other words, it's not enough to be a chacham in chachmas haTorah. You also have to know the various kinds of tricks and things that all the different con men and swindlers and whatever are going to try to use. We had earlier in the Masechta as well, we had something along those lines where Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says about certain dishonest business practices, where he said, Oylim Oymar, Oylim Loy Oymar, woe to me if I say them, because then people are going to learn, hey, you know, I never thought of this, versus woe if I don't say, because then the cheaters are going to think that Abaya and are not wise to what we're doing. And we said in the end, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai did teach these things. Yeah. Okay. So the Gemara tells in another story about false signatures. There was a shtar with the two signatures on it of Edim or Dayanim or whatever were Rava and Rav Acha Ba'ada. Also, I made the Rava, and the shtar was brought to Rava for him to certify, is this his valid signature? Omalei, so Rava says, Ein, chasimas yododi dihi. Yes, indeed, this is my signature. Mihu, however, I can tell you that it's false because kamei de Rav Acha Ba'ada lo chasimi li me'olam. I never signed before Rav Acha Ba'ada. Rav Acha Ba'ada was older than Rava. So as a matter of derech eretz, Rava would never have signed first. The same way you have Edim by a ksuba, for example, Edim by a tznoim or whatever, you always have the Rav, the Masada Kedushin will always tell you the older one should sign first. So in the same way, Rava is saying, he or my signature appears first, and that can't possibly be valid. taxi. So they tied the guy up to give him Malchus, or at least to threaten to give him Malchus or whatever. But Oidi, and the guy confessed that he had forged the star. Omalei, so Rava asked him, you have to explain to me, the Shlema de Gizaifus, I understand how you were able to forge my signature. I'm a young man, relatively speaking, and I have a very straight and clear handwriting. Ela de Rav Acha Ba'ada, de Rosis Yode, but Rav Acha Ba'ada, his hands shake. Heichi Abdus, he's old, his hands tremble. How were you able to forge such a signature? Omalei, so the guy tells Rava, Anchi Yodai Ametzra. I put my hand on the metzra. A metzra is a plank bridge. Sometimes you would have on a river, so you might have a permanent bridge built. You might instead have a ferry. Sometimes they would have, especially if you have, let's say, for example, workers have to get quickly from one side to the other. They haven't got time for ferries or any such thing. So they would have a plank that was laid across the river, and then next to it you would have, as kind of a handrail, you'd have a rope running along the side of it. That would still, that you'd have stakes stuck into the ground at the both ends, and maybe in some place here and there in the middle, and you'd have a rope pass through them, and it would serve as like a handrail to hold on to while you're crossing the thing. So the guy says, I put my hand on that, and then I signed it. So now it's shaking all the time from people walking on it or whatever, so therefore it was able to simulate a shaky handwriting. But Amri Lo, or others say, Kom Azarnuka, he stood on top of a, he stood on top of a large skin bag that they use to fill with water or whatever. And also when you stand on it, it wobbles this way and that, the kotzav, and then he wrote the signature that way, because also it wobbles and therefore you can simulate a shaky handwriting that way. The point is, in other words, again, a Rav has to realize such things are possible and to know what methods a person might have available to forge things and be aware of those and then be on the lookout for them.
Was it Kam Azruka?
Kam, he stood Azanuka on a skin bag. Rashbam explains, Shadur the Mayim Minabur. They would use it, would be like a bag, large bag made out of skin, made out of an animal skin that they would use to draw water. So now, when you stand on such a thing, when it's full or half full of water or air or whatever, it'll wobble. And think of like nowadays, if you stand like on a bean bag or on one of these, stand on a trampoline or something, it's going to be the same kind of thing if it's going to wobble and therefore it'll.
What did we learn from this last safe report?
The point is that we learned this is how the guy was able to forge a shaky handwriting, and therefore, in other words, you should be aware such things are possible, and a dayan should be on the lookout for it. The last couple of dafim of the Perek and of the Masechta deal with various dinim of an orev. The Gemara makes a point that you have, in particular, you have different kinds of orev. You have a regular orev, and then you have an orev kablon, and the Gemara deals in some detail what the difference between them is and what exactly the chiyuv of each one is. A regular orev, for example, the din is, in halacha, you can't go and demand payment from the orev first. You first have to try the loiva. If the loiva defaults, then you go to the orev, as opposed to an orev kablon, where you're able to go straight to the orev kablon. We have by tznoyim, you have arevim kablonim, and in principle, if the chosins and kalos parents don't fulfill their obligations as making the wedding, then you go to the orev kablon and you demand payment from him. So the Gemara says, "Amar Rav Huna, minayim la'orev de mishtabed? How do we know b'chlal that an orev is putting himself under a shibud in the first place? After all, Rashbam points out there's no kinyan involved. So just he's saying I'm an orev, that's enough to make him an orev? Nowadays, in practice, we usually do a kinyan. We usually have by tznoyim, for example. You have the rov will take out his handkerchief or pen or whatever, and he'll have each of the arevim kablon and do a kinyan. But in principle, you don't need that." So how do you know? Dichtiv, because we find by Yehuda. He says to Yaakov, we have to bring Binyamin with us to Mitzrayim. Onoichi e'ervenu, I will be his orev. Miyodi t'rakshenu, you can demand him from my hand. So you see that Yehuda is taking responsibility and saying that I have full responsibility. Now there's no kinyan over there. Yehuda is just saying it verbally. So we see that such a thing works in halacha. However, this isn't a regular orev, this is an orev kablon, where one meaning of orev kablon is, as Gemara has a few different opinions, what exactly makes a person an orev kablon, one of them can be where he just says, I'm a kablon. Then you can even have a case where nosim and nosim b'yad, Rashbam points out. You can have a case, for example, Reuven is lending money to Shimon, and Levi is actually the go-between. Levi actually takes the money from Reuven and brings it to Shimon. Then not only is he not an orev, then b'chlal, he himself is considered a loiva. But you have an order of Tablon would be where Shimon is actually receiving the money from Reuven's hand, but Levi is saying, I will be an order of Tablon. The Gemara discusses, is it that Levi says specifically to Reuven, I will be an order of Tablon, or how exactly does he make himself a Tablon? There's a few different opinions. Anyway, the point is, here he's saying that you can demand him from me, so then that amounts to Kablonos. So that doesn't show that a regular order is Meshulban. Fine, it shows an order of Kablon is Meshulban. Maharsha points out that dichtiv, because the pasuk says Tzna Oisei Al Yodi, give him into my hands, Vani Yashivenu, and I will return him. In effect, that's an order of Tablon, so not a regular order. Now, Maharsha points out actually that these are said by two different people. Tzna Oisei Al Yodi is Reuven saying. Anochi Erevenu was after Yaakov refused to listen to what Reuven has to say, because he says it's Shnei Bonai Thomas, and he says a B'chor Shoita, etc. So finally, Yehuda waits until the right time, until the food has run out, and then he says to Yaakov, look, we have no choice, and Anochi Erevenu. So how are we learning it's the same thing? So Maharsha explains, because if Reuven used the words Tzna Oisei Al Yodi Vani Yashivenu, which makes him an order of Tablon, we can certainly assume that Yehuda wasn't going to take on less of an Arevus than that. Because if Yaakov refused to accept Reuven's, even as an order of Tablon, he certainly wouldn't accept from Yehuda as a plain Orev. Therefore, we have to understand that Yehuda also was saying that he's going to be an order of Tablon, even though he doesn't use the wording of it. So therefore, the Gemara can assume that he was an order of Tablon, but not a regular Orev. There's also, though, I'll be showing him a point out, the Ritvah has a girsa over here in the Maseres HaShas. It brings a girsa that another question the Gemara has is that really, in effect, forget about an order of Tablon, in effect, Yehuda is making himself the borrower. Again, not like a Tablon, but rather Nosim and Nosim B'Yad, because he's literally saying, give Binyamin to me, and I will return him to you. That makes it, he's making himself the loiva. That doesn't show that an order is actually taking a shibud on himself. So Ella, I'm going to be Tzot Mehocha. No, rather we can learn the fact that an Orev takes a responsibility on himself just with words, Mehocha, Pesuk and Mishle. Kach, Big Daikir, Lakach, or Kach, there's actually two different Pesuk and Mishle. One says Lakach, one says Kach. Kach, Big Daikir, Orav Zer, take his clothing because he was an Orev to a stranger, over Ad Nochria, and for a foreigner, Chavlehu, take a Mashkin from him. So in other words, we're saying that the Pesuk is addressing the Malva. Shlomo is addressing the Malva. He became an Orev for a strange person, for not even for a friend or something. Therefore, you can take his clothing and you can take a Mashkin from him. If the Loiva defaults, then you have the right to go after the Orev and even take his clothing or a Mashkin from him if necessary. So we see from that Pesuk that there's a concept of Arevus, and it doesn't mention Kablonus over there, so therefore it means a plain Orev. But Omer, and you have another pasuk that expresses this idea. Shlomo says, also in Mishle, Bni, my son, meaning my Talmud, im orav to l'reicha, if you become an orev to your friend, tokat lazor kapecha, if you made a handshake with a stranger and accepted on yourself that you're going to be an orev, the result is, nekashta v'imreficha, you have now ensnared yourself in with the words of your mouth. So the Gemara is going to explain, and Ashban explains what it means over here. This is saying something else. The first pasuk, imarav t'loreicha takat lazor kapecha, means that you took on arevo, so some kind of financial obligation like that. Nekashta v'imreficha is talking about if you insulted the guy or cursed him or whatever, no kadab, so now you've snared yourself with what you said with your mouth, no kadab, you've been trapped with the words of your mouth. So you're in trouble one way or the other, whether because you took on a financial obligation or whether because you said something insulting and cursing to another person. So what should you do? Shlomo continues with advice. So my son, this then is what you should do and be saved. Because now you've come into your friend's hand. In other words, now like you owe him one. So go hisrapes or a hat, which we'll explain in a second. What that means, or a havreyecha, and do many friends. So what is that? And the simple meaning of hisrapes means like abase yourself, like humble yourself before him, and then tell him how sorry you are or whatever. But the Gemara is explaining imaman yeshleviyoncha means if you actually owe him money because you're an orev, after like pisas yad hisrapes, after pisas, open up your hand and pay him what you owe him. As an Orev, and then you'll go back to the Loiva and demand repayment from him. The Imlav, and if not, it's a matter of you insulted him or something, Harbi Olav Reim, bring many friends to help ask Mechila. As the Gemara tells us in Yuma, that in fact, a person, when he needs to ask somebody else Mechila, it's not necessarily a one-to-one, one-on-one thing. He may have to bring three friends and do this three times, repeat this three times, and ask Mechila from the guy. Basra explains in a little detail over here that we're talking about a few different cases. First, you can have he's an orev for a total stranger, and that's the pasuk of saying ki orev zur. Then you can have where it's for a friend, imoravdolorei echo. And then however you have tokatol azur katecha, however you gave a handshake to the malva relative to you. He's a zur because you don't know him that personally. And now, so you became an orev, but now you're stuck. So now you have to work your way out of it. And hatole pisas yadu, Marshall explains that also it may mean arrange payments with him on installments. You may not be able to pay it all at once, but at least arrange to pay him in installments.
There are,
we'll bring proof, we'll bring a star or something, we'll bring a shoiver or whatever, yeah. We'll bring Adam or whatever. Fine. The last Mishnah of the Masechta deals with more dinim of Orev, and then you have, in that connection, you have Machlokas between Rabbi Shmuel and Ben-Nanas, Rabbi Shimon Ben-Nanas, about a certain case whether a person is considered an Orev or not. So the Mishnah says, Omer Rabbi Shmuel, Harotza Sheyachkim, if a person wants to be wise in Torah, Yasik V'dinim Mominus. He should involve himself in learning Dinim Mominus. She'en Lachom Ksoya B'Torah HaYosem Ehen. There is no area of Torah that is better, and then that a person gets as much chokhmah out of as them. V'hem K'mayin HaNeveya, they're like a well, they're like a spring that's constantly welling forth. Because you always have people always coming up with new ideas, new financial instruments, and new business deals of various kinds and all that. But also you have, Parshat, there's a tremendous amount of chokhmah. You have many basic ideas and concepts and musogim and Torah that come from Dinim Mominus. Marshall explains in some detail over here also that from Dinim Mominus you can get to becoming more expert in Dinim Nefoshis, and in fact he explains that's the advantage of what Ben-Nanas describes in the Mishnah, a case over here where Reuven owes Shimon money and he's not paying up, and one day Shimon meets up with Reuven in the street and is like grabbing him by the neck and knew, where's my money? And then a guy comes along and says, fine, I'll be the Orev. So you see, it's in a little shtickle like Dinim Nefoshis. So therefore, so you see that from being expert in Dinim Mominus, you can come to learn about Dinim Nefoshis as well. And Marshall says, that's what we're going to learn. Masechta Sanhedrin is going to be next, about Dinim Nefoshis. So therefore, a person should be learning those. The Harod says, Shiyasik, the Dinim Mominus, and Rabbi Shmuel continues, if a person really wants to learn Dinim Mominus thoroughly and know them inside and out, Yishamish, as Shimon Ben-Nanas, then he should be serving and being a personal Talmud and a personal servant of Shimon Ben-Nanas, who is so expert in these dinim. By the way, the Gemara mentions that even though Rabbi Shmuel gives this tremendous compliment to Shimon Ben-Nanas, nevertheless, the halacha is not like him. The halacha is like Rabbi Shmuel, after all, but yeah.
The rabbi, it says that dinis korbanot, the manufos, and all those things are
much... Those are gufei Torah. Those are gufei
Torah. Those are much more...
There's different aspects. You know, there's chokhmah sadas, with kodshim and taharis. But he was saying that there's a certain type of chokhmah that you get from dinim mominus more than anything else.
Okay, sure.
Okay. Yomim Mashiach Gula, Bayz Ear.
No, see him, I think.
Yeah, so we didn't finish the whole Masech. We're just saying Yaakov of it, but yeah. When we finish saying Yaakov as a whole, we make a seed message anyway. Okay. Fine, so we have the Bayz Ear, L'Chila Ribis, the Rebbe talks about one of the main features of the Rebbe Arash's Avoda was about L'Chila Ribis. As we know that Eber Shab explained that nowadays we don't do things with Seder Adroga. Nowadays is the time of the last Berurim before Ikva Seder Mashiach. So now you don't need a Seder and a particular order in how you do the Berurim and the Tikkunim, meaning just grab any opportunity that you have, any good opportunity, even if on the face of it you're not Shaykh to this. This is what L'Chila Ribis means.
What is it?
It means that, in other words, grab any opportunity to do a mitzvah, to promote mitzvahs and then Torah, even if right now you don't seem to be shayach to it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Continuing with halachas of tzitzis. So now you put four strings into each corner and then you fold them over to make eight. You would be allowed to. You have one extremely long string. You could fold it into four, and then put it into the corner, into the holes, and then you double it, and you have eight, and then you can cut the ends of the strings. That's fine. But if you only remembered to cut the strings after you started doing any of the windings, even if you did only one winding and then you did even one knot, then it would be possible because minat Torah, that's enough. One winding and one knot is enough because the pasuk doesn't say how many windings there's supposed to be. So therefore, it was made with psul, and therefore you have the problem of tas of alay minat asri. So if though, the Alter Rebbe goes on to say, if you cut the strings apart after you made one choya, before you made the knot, then that's fine because you don't have the minimum that's necessary for tzitzis minat Torah because you need at least one winding and then on top of that you need one knot. Nevertheless, better to cut them apart before you even put them in the hole, and that way you don't do any part of the tzitzis b'psul.
Again, nowadays, you're just going to buy a prepackaged swings 99% of the time anyhow, so realistically, you're probably not going to come across that unless you really do, unless you start rolling your own.